Space Thought Crime. I am your host, Wesley Fox, proconsul and editor of PrescientSciFi.com. And this week, a very, very big anniversary came across. It was the 50th anniversary of the, I think it was the first episode, the premiere episode of Star Trek, back on September 8th, 1966. 50 years. And being a big-time Trekkie as I am, and a huge nerd, and this is a science fiction podcast, I'm legally required to sit down and talk about this and go on and on and on. I decided to do this kind of off the cuff, so this is going to be a little disorganized. I do have a sheet here, which is what I usually have when I talk. It kind of organizes my thoughts, kind of an outline. I did an outline for this, but I basically just listed off a bunch of shit, and so it's not really organized very well. Also, Star Trek, The Next Generation in particular, is really opened up a lot of things to me in terms of hobbies, interests, passions. It's inevitably what led me to start writing science fiction, albeit about 20 years after I saw the show. But it is just a very, very important piece of culture in my life and in a lot of people's lives. And so in this episode, I might go off a little bit. This might be a little disorganized. I'm pretty sure I can do this without getting a little emotional, but I might. So, and I probably will try not to edit. I don't think I'm going to edit any of it out. I probably will if it gets really weird. But there might be a little bit of weirdness in this too. But I mean, this is all going to be about the whole franchise of Star Trek, the whole big thing, the original, Next Generation. I mean, I'm going to talk about the whole thing, its impact on all of us, the impact on me, most importantly. I think there's a lot of documentaries, and a lot of people can talk about its impact on society, and I probably will talk about that a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit. But I'm going to also talk about what this meant for me, what it means for what these things have meant for scientists, for people that has inspired. I've seen a lot of the documentaries, like Trek Nations, Trekkies, Building Star Trek. The Captains. I mean, a lot of these documentaries are available on Netflix. I highly recommend, if you are a Trekkie, to watch them. If you are in any way interested in what Star Trek means to our culture and to the country, and what it means to the Trekkies, to the people that are obsessed with this stuff, that have been going to the conventions, I highly recommend you watch a few of those. If you are not a Trekkie, if you're not really into the show, well, you shouldn't be listening to this. So I'm just going to assume that everyone listening to this is. But I highly recommend those documentaries I just listed. Also, if you're totally into Star Trek, I highly recommend listening to some of Jesse Mercury's sci-fi podcasts. He goes through like all the episodes of The Next Generation, almost one by one, with his co-hosts. And he's a huge Star Trek fan. And so he also has his own perspective and how, you know, everyone has something different they love about Star Trek, and then there's also something that we all love about it. It's kind of a weird, we all share something, but then there's also, it's almost like a la carte, you know? There's things over here that I might love, things over here that, I mean, well, all right, I'll stop. Anyway, I'm also sitting here having a drink. I usually used to do this with Microsoft Matt and John a little bit. Usually when I'm solo, I do have a drink, but I don't really talk about it. But I think for this one, I thought I would. It is, it's from Gizmo Brew Works here in Raleigh, North Carolina. This brew is called Beekeeper. It is a honey wheat, if you would have guessed. And, as you can imagine, it has a little bit of, obviously it's on the sweet side. It has a little bit of floral nose and fruity flavors. It has a hint of clove. I'm not really a fan of that part of this beer, but the rest of it I like a lot. It's light body. It's a really smooth beer. It's also just very, very easy to drink, but it is on the sweet side. I've been enjoying this for the last 10-15 minutes. I got one of these pint and 6 ounce giant bottles, so I have quite a lot of work to do. I also had some wine with dinner, so if I start slurring my speech, I don't apologize. That's you're just gonna have to deal with it. So that's what's going on over here. All right. Star Trek. Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages. Yada, yada. It was... The show began on such a positive, aspirational note. that in the future we are going to go way out there, and we are going to see it's capturing the explorer, the frontiersman, you know, and the drive we have to go see those places we have not seen before and to know the things we do not know, you know, the explorers, Christopher Columbus, Leif Erikson, these people that went into the boats and just went all over the earth, Captain Cook in the Pacific Ocean, Magellan. Later on, we, of course, have our space program. I skipped one. We had the people that went west when we first became a country. Lewis and Clark explored the Louisiana Purchase. And you went out into the great frontier, the wildlands, where we kind of knew what was there, but we really didn't. You know, there was all sorts of wonders, the Grand Canyon. But there's these people that they didn't want to stay cooped up in these cities and in these familiar areas. They wanted to branch out on their own. They wanted to see what was out there and that tradition. And we like to call it here like an American tradition of going farther out to keep extending. You know, we were the first in flight. We were the first to the moon, although we were not the first to space. And even now, with NASA and our space programs and talks of going to Mars, we've been doing these things recently, and Star Trek kind of captured some of that and kind of took it a step further. 300 years that in the future, we are going to keep doing that. And we're going to go see more than just Mars. We're going to see other stars, other planets. We're going to find alien beings. We're going to see things that we can barely grasp. We don't even understand, we don't even know what's out there until we go out there. It's nothing in it. And it was aspirational. It was positive. There's a whole big universe out there for us to explore. And Star Trek started with that idea. And it wasn't the first science fiction. It wasn't the first space opera. But it was the first to kind of parse it in means of, we are going out there. This is a mission. Like, this is what we are going to do. This isn't Flash Gordon. This isn't like the pulp science fiction where you got superheroes with laser blasters, you know, saving space princesses, or some of the more heady, hard science fiction like Asimov, or the social science fiction like Heinlein. Those things had some of these elements in them, but they were more serious. They were about technology. They were about kind of hardened intellectual meditations on what the future may hold for us and the challenges and et cetera, et cetera. But it wasn't really positive, aspirational. Didn't really capture that kind of explorers, that you know, that daredevil mentality. If I really got into the rest of it, but I guess the best way to kind of sum up too, and that's like just the way it starts. Star Trek has so many facets to it as a franchise, the movies, the TV shows. It has so much to it. It is the premier, and in my opinion, because of all the different things it has done, and it can do, and the ways it has, the different ways, I'm having a hard time even describing it. For all the reasons, and also obviously its popularity as well, but it is, to me, in my opinion, it is the top science fiction franchise. It is the premier franchise. If there was a Mount Rushmore of science fiction, it's Gene Roddenberry, Kirk, and Picard. And then throw in whoever you want for number four. But those... that it is the top one, because it's like the grand unified theory. It brought in everything. Every science fiction trope you can think of is in a Star Trek episode. Every single one. It covers all of them. And it covers all of them in such a thoughtful and thought-provoking and just effective way, and even plausible way. It's even more plausible than a lot of the others. So it's kind of this unifying force. It's really is... that's its reach, that's its strength, and that's why I think it is what drives nerds nuts, and it's why it built this really fanatical and committed fan base, even though it was only on TV for 3 seasons, starting in 1966 and ending in 68, I guess. And then that was it. It was over. But they were having conventions, and they started this whole kind of subculture all through the 70s, and there were people talking about Star Trek, even though it had not been on TV for years. Scientists everywhere, growing up, even the ones that are around now in major Fortune 500 tech companies, will tell you they all remember watching Star Trek, even though it was only on for 3 years. It hit everyone that strongly, that quickly, because of its reach, because of its intelligence, its thoughtfulness, and that's just the first show. I haven't even gotten into The Next Generation yet. And the really amazing thing about this franchise is not only its breadth, its reach, its strength, but also despite the fact that it has produced several mediocre movies, and some of the series didn't do so well. The latest one, Enterprise, really wasn't that good. Even though it has all these kind of things to it that really weren't that popular, like Star Trek Nemesis was a bomb, in my opinion. It was not a good movie. A lot of people did not like Insurrection. I thought it was a pretty decent movie. First Contact, I thought, was pretty good. Generations, I think, and I'm trying to think, The Final Frontier, Star Trek V, the original Star Trek I, the motion picture with V'ger. I mean, there's some eggs dropped. And despite all that, there are still millions and millions of fanatical fans. That's a redundancy, sorry. About this franchise, and they wanted more, and they got more in the reboot starring Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto and Carl Urban, and you know, so it's still alive. It just refuses to die, even though it goes off the air for 12 years between Star Trek, the original series, and the first movie, despite the fact we haven't had a TV show in 11 years, and the last movie was in the early 2000s, I forget when. And then they completely reboot it, reset the timeline and everything, despite all the setbacks and all the strange things they've done to it that if it were any other franchise, it would just do tremendous permanent damage. Star Trek just will never go away. I love it for it, and I love the fans, and I love that this has never died. Star Trek, it is it's an idea that can't die. It's a franchise, it's what it stands for and everything it's done. If it dies, if Star Trek ever does go away, that's like the end of Western civilization. It's the end of civilization. I mean, there's so much in there that needs to be told and needs to be seen. Okay, I'm going to get into the outline now. All right, so I think I just went on a rant for about 10 minutes. All right, why I love Star Trek, personally. I got introduced, and I mentioned this in a previous podcast. I got introduced to Star Trek through Star Trek The Next Generation. I started watching on an old TV channel. It eventually became UPN, but at the time it was something else. And I watched The Next Generation, and then I watched a marathon of it in my brother's room when I was about 9 years old. He was staying at a friend's house or out partying or whatever. He was like 9 years older than me, so he was, you know, didn't want anything to do with me. But he had a TV in his room, and I wanted to watch TV, and I didn't want to watch what everyone else was watching. And I go in there, and I started watching Star Trek, and I was already kind of a nerdy kid. And I found it. I found Star Trek, and I watched probably 6 hours of it that night, ending with the two-part Best of Both Worlds, and fell in love with it after that. Every time it was on TV, I watched it. I don't even remember... I didn't watch them in order back then, you know, that I didn't, I was a kid I think it was on reruns around that time. I couldn't really remember. I don't really know what the situation, it was 1991. So maybe I was still on TV and still running, you know, new. So it wasn't reruns. I don't know. I can't really remember, but I just fell in love with it. The technology of it just felt so real. The ship, everything about it, like, it felt so real. It just felt like, yeah, that's going to be us. Like, we are going to be like that in the future. That's how things are going to be. We're going to have all those things. And that is what life is going to be like. We just need to get there. And I just wanted to know more and more and more. And that's, eventually I started reading other science fiction. I started watching other science fiction movies. I went through all the Star Trek movies within a couple weeks, which back then was pretty hard to do because we didn't have streaming or Netflix or anything, so I had to borrow VHS tapes, and I eventually watched them all. And I loved Wrath of Khan, of course. I also loved Journey Home with the ship. Actually, for a while, I thought the Klingon Bird of Prey was the Enterprise. I was really confused because I was like, I don't remember the Enterprise having a cloaking device. Like, did Picard have a cloaking? I was really backwards back then. So I figured it all out. And it was just a beautiful thing to see that, yes, there were problems and there was challenges. Obviously, you wouldn't have much of a movie or a TV show if there were no conflict. But you saw that in the future, not only would we have all this technology, our society would come to embrace and value intelligence, hard work, science, all the things that I was and a lot of kids my age were basically being made fun of in middle school and high school and elementary school. Being smart was something that you laughed at. You know, you don't, especially boys back when I was growing up, boys, if you were smart, you were a nerd. And then your entire personality, your entire like position in the class and in the cliques was dictated by that. You could not be anything else. You could not be a nerd and a you know, jock or athlete at the same time. Now that has changed now, but to some extent, but back then that is not the, you know, that's not the impression I ever got. And especially being a Trek fan, being a Trekkie at that age, you were definitely in a weird category. And in fact, I didn't tell people I was into Star Trek. I was afraid to. And to watch in Star Trek, to see everyone in this society valuing intelligence, valuing kind of integrity, leadership, you know, problem solving. These weren't, I mean, consider the other things on TV in comparison to Star Trek, where it's the tough cop who gets the job done using a giant gun. It's the soldier. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger and Stallone shooting the place up. It was, you know, sports movies. You know, that was like herodom. That was how you got things done, at least from a kid's perspective around then. Like, everything else was about force. It was about violence. And it was also about lashing out. I mean, a lot of these heroes had serious character flaws. They were drinkers a lot of the times. They were not in touch with their feminine side, their emotions. They were immature. Almost all of them were immature. And they weren't really, none of them were really all that smart. I mean, there was some exceptions. There was MacGyver. And I mean, I'm blanking on a few others. I think the A-Team, I mean, they were very clever. But also they included guns and explosions. So it's kind of hard to separate the two. Star Trek was the one where it was all about brains. That's how you solve problems in the future. And, you know, to see that and be like, wow, we're going to be so much better. And like people like me, you know, at the time, we're going to be more important and what we can contribute will be valued. Whereas at the time, what I could contribute was basically worthless. Everything I did, you know, my obsession with Star Trek, with science fiction, my love of video games, which granted, that's not very, typically not very useful. That was all considered just nerdy boy stuff that no one else cared about except for other nerdy boys. So, and to see, and as I grew up, you also see kind of in the future, humanity as a whole, all the different nations, the races would be unified, that we would transcend a lot of the problems we have today. Like, that, I mean, that was the other message of Star Trek, that in the future, a lot of the problems we have now, we won't have them in the future. Racism, the Cold War, you know, all the poverty, famine, you know, all these other things, they're going to be gone. We're going to have a whole new set of problems that are going to be different, and it's going to take a different kind of person and a different kind of people to solve them. And so it was kind of transcendent. It was, you know, it was kind of utopian, basically utopian. And it was just mind-blowing, and it just made you feel really good about, okay, things will get better. Things suck right now for me as a person, as a nerdy kid, but they will get better. And it was just kind of inspirational in that way. I think the biggest thing I took away from all of this, and the one, I think I just mentioned it before, the problem solving, the way they overcame things in the show, it wasn't brute force. It wasn't sheer force of will. It wasn't, you just have to be fearless and courageous. And it wasn't a hero's journey. I mean, there was plenty of hero's journeys out there. There was plenty of that tradition out there in American cinema and American television. You know, it was the Westerns, the police procedurals, the war movies, the Schwarzenegger, Stallone, whatever. I mean, there was plenty of those where it was about courage. It was about, you know, staring death in the face and kind of making death blink. Star Trek was the problem solving. It was using like logic, reason, the scientific method. It was basically solving problems using your head and not courage. And there is or courage or force, whatever. Yes, the crew of Star Trek and of the USS Enterprise are courageous, and there are moments where they do stare death in the face, and they are brave, and they do those things. But a lot of the problem solving is identifying the problem, identifying the phenomenon, and finding a way around it without just shooting. In fact, that's what I got from Star Trek: The Next Generation. Is they solved so many problems without using phasers and torpedoes. And as a kid, I always thought, like, man, they could just shoot it, right? But then they'd find a way around it. And then you would finally appreciate that they'd solve all these problems without killing anyone or without hurting people. In fact, they would go out of their way. And so that also, it didn't appeal to me at first. But as I get into high school and whatever, I started to appreciate that. All right. I'm going to get really nerdy here for a second. Like, even more nerdy than normal Star Trek nerdy. In college and a little bit in law school, I studied differing views on political philosophy in terms of international relations, how states deal with each other, how political factions deal with each other, and how to manage that and how to maintain stability and peace. And there's kind of two prevailing kind of wisdoms, and one of them was, I think everyone would know it probably from Machiavelli's The Prince. It's been called realism, as in, this is the real world, this is how you do things in the real world, you know, get used to it. Or it's been called realpolitik, kind of a variation of a German word. I'm not sure if it has, actually those are the two biggest ways, but it's usually kind of like being practical, just it's about self-interest, balance of power, and it's about stability, maintaining order, and it's about maintaining your role in the international system, your role as a state, your role as a country, as an empire, or whatever. And a lot of it involved the use of force. And Machiavelli and a lot of the people who espouse this, they didn't think that you solve problem. They didn't think you solved all problems with force. That's kind of like a straw man. What they thought was that the use of force has a role in politics, in statecraft, in the world. That's just a reality of the world. You have to use force, and you have to be brutal and cruel. And I think the big line from Machiavelli is, you have to learn how to be bad. You have to learn how to be evil and do dark things in order to survive, in order to protect your people, protect your state. And that was really the prevailing wisdom for a lot of people through the Cold War. And even before that, it's always been kind of a part of the American tradition. We've always been, before World War II, we were isolationists. We always felt like our interests were best served by just not getting involved. And that partially served us up until the World Wars. And then it just became, and then after World War II, we became obsessed with realpolitik and the balance of power, stability. And then you throw in nuclear weapons, first strike capability, second strike, mutually assured destruction, et cetera, et cetera. And that was kind of the view of the world. And it was kind of dark. It was a little depressing. It was kind of thinking, well, this is just the way things are always going to be with humanity. That's just the way we are. And then that was realism. On the other side was a new school, which some people attribute to John Locke, others to, there's all sorts of famous thinkers through the 19th and 20th centuries, but it's basically called liberalism or idealism. The idea that the international system should be arranged and we should behave in the world as to make it better, to advance it, that through cooperation and through integration and through all sorts of non-force means, we can become a better people. And usually the criticism with them, and a lot of time, and this is where the League of Nations idea came from, this is where the United Nations came from, this is where a lot of NGOs and world organizations come from, this idea that we should just drop the regular, you know, power politics and just cooperate on the things that we can cooperate on and leave the rest to dialogue and diplomacy and whatever. The criticism the criticism on that one was always that they want to treat the world as their idyllic utopian world. The problem is that is not the way the world is right now. And so so a lot of them know what they want the world to be, what they want this new system to be, but they have no idea how to get there. And that's kind of, so those are the two systems. And Star Trek abandons realism entirely and says, in the future, we will transcend that and we will reach that idealistic, liberal international system. And I use the word liberal in the kind of academic sense, not like liberal, conservative, left-wing, right-wing. What I mean is we believe in a better way of dealing with other countries and dealing with states and dealing with international problems. It is utopian, it is idyllic, and it's not always clearly defined. A lot of the ideas, like they kind of say what they want, but they don't really know how to get it. Star Trek sets up where we've already passed all those problems. We've solved them. The Earth is unified as one. Humanity is one, and we are now part of a interstellar, interspecies alliance called the United Federation of Planets. And we transcend it. And it was kind of, it didn't beat you over the head like how we did it. It didn't criticize people, whether you were conservative, Democrat, Republican, liberal, whatever. It was like, look, in 200, 300 years, we're going to be past all that. We won't get into the details of how we did it, but rest assured that one day we will get past this and we will not have nuclear weapons pointed at each other as we did in 1966. The way that Star Trek would cover these ideas is not by showing them within humanity. They would show these challenges of humanity and the Federation dealing with alien species like the Romulans. And the classic, there's a bunch of episodes here I wrote down, but the one that people will cite from the original series is Balance of Terror. And in that one, there was an uneasy peace between the Romulans and the Federation. There was no dialogue, and yet this Romulan ship shows up and starts attacking Federation outposts. The Enterprise intervenes, and the Enterprise and Kirk are so worried about starting a war. Even though one could argue the Romulans already started a war by attacking the few outposts, but they kind of remind each other that, look, they didn't invade. Like, there's only one ship doing this. The rest of them are, so where's the rest of the fleet? Like, where's the big move? Like, the rest of our neutral zone is intact, so what happened here? And so they kind of decide, well, we have to retaliate, but how do we do this? We can't talk to each other. We don't talk to each other. We don't really know what this ship is doing, whether this is just a rogue ship, a one-time thing. And there's this just fear that these two sides, because they don't know each other. We don't know anything about the Romulans, and they don't appear to know anything about us. And so the balance of terror, instead of balance of power, they call it balance of terror. And it's really what drives the policies of both sides is the fear of the other, because they just don't know them. They don't understand them. It's a pretty good episode. I think it kind of skipped over the fact that a Romulan ship did just kill a lot of Federation citizens and just kind of poo-poo that as like, oh, that's not really a big deal. We should not start a war. And kind of from what I saw, there was a war already started. You also have kind of this idea in the most recent reboot of Star Trek Into Darkness with Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan. But in this show, Peter Weller, Admiral Marcus, believes that we need to be prepared for war. And actually, he's willing to start a war with the Klingons because he thinks it's inevitable. And so he builds the Dreadnought-class starship. He sends Kirk in to be the bait, basically bait the Klingons into war. And then he would come in with his super weapons and finish them off. He just thinks they're not worth talking to. We might as well just destroy them now because they're just going to come after... The war is going to come anyway, so let's just destroy them now. Basically, the idea of first strike in nuclear war and in the Cold War. Into Darkness came out well after the Cold War, so that theme probably did not hit as hard as it could have if this was the Cold War. And I guess the idea of preemptive strike, we kind of have some thoughts of that because of the Iraq War. And our idea that we have to hit them first, or we have to hit these terrorist organizations that may not have hit us yet, et cetera, et cetera. The other one, I just, and these are, this probably has to be my two of my favorite pieces of television, is the two episodes of Best of Both Worlds of Star Trek The Next Generation with the Borg. The Borg are like probably the best enemy they've ever come up with. A hive mind society. They don't care about diplomacy. They don't care about the Federation. They do not care about Picard's high-minded idealism. They have come to kill you and assimilate you. That's it. Period. There is nothing redeeming about them. This is all they do. And that kind of, and also the fear of being part of a hive mind, having your individuality, your liberty, and all taken away, your power, all for the good of the state, or the Borg, you know, the collective. That's kind of, you know, harkens back to the ideas of fascism, where the state is more important than the people, or the country is more important than any of the people in it, and the people in it must sacrifice for the good of the whole. You know, that was the rationale behind a lot of Nazi Germany's policies. Some American policies have been set that way, where the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. But of course, in this case, the many just means the state. It doesn't actually mean like more people. It just means what the state the government matters more than the people. Of course, they don't say that. They always say something else that sounds better. But that was an amazing two shows. The loss of Picard, the tactical means of which eventually they did have to destroy the Borg, because there was just no other way. They didn't. And there's enemies like that, and we're facing one now in Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, or Daesh. They don't want to treat with us. They don't want to speak with us. They don't want a detente or a peace. They want to destroy anything that's not them. And they'll settle for Syria or whatever, but in the end, they will come after us. They hate us. They want nothing to do with us. And no amount of goodwill or outreach will change that. Now, we all know, and we've all been told and beaten to death with this point, that not all Muslims feel that way. That is true. Most Muslims do not feel that way. 95%, 96%. I don't know what the number is, but Al-Qaeda and ISIS do. So right out there, separate that. So nobody can accuse me of oversimplifying things. But that was that episode, that there is things out there that just want to kill you. There are predators out there, and it kind of harkens back that no matter how hard you try to use your liberalism or idealism in your foreign policy and your ethics, you know, whether it's Picard or Kirk, the Federation, the Prime Directive, there are some things out there that just want to kill you, and you have to be able to identify that and react accordingly. But then there's other cases where it's the Klingons who end up being an ally of the Federation. Now, if we would have concluded, like Admiral Marcus did, that they're just the enemy and we need to destroy them before they destroy us, we would have lost that future opportunity to have an ally in the Klingon Empire, which we do have in The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. And that's also true of the United States in common day with Japan and Germany. Both countries are now allies. Even though they nowadays, like as time has wore on, they don't have to be allies, Germany in particular, but they are nonetheless. So a lot of our enemies of the past, people that we used to dehumanize in propaganda, and sometimes we may have felt that we should just annihilate them, have ended up becoming allies, or at least, you know, friendlies, at least neutrals. So that's kind of the different. Those are like the two different approaches to dealing with the other, the enemy, or the unknown, the fear of the unknown. And there's a few other episodes that are relevant. I won't go into them as much. There was an episode called The High Ground where Dr. Crusher is kidnapped by terrorists and made to help patch their people up. And there's this kind of discussion on negotiating with terrorism, dealing with terrorism, these groups that will use asymmetric warfare, irregular means to get their way because they can't win through conventional means. And I had a professor in law school that kept beating that to death in all of us. In all our classes, he would always come back to that. And he said, do you know why Hamas and Hezbollah and these other groups do not fight fair or don't fight by the laws of war? Because if they did, they'd lose. So why would they fight by our rules if they know they're going to lose? They don't have the armies we have. They don't have the resources. If they fight and abide by those, you know, the international system, they're going to lose. So they got to find a way to fight us where they won't lose. And we call that asymmetric warfare. More recently, we've called a lot of those tactics terrorism. And Dr. Beverly Crusher dealt with that in a very real way. So those, and a couple things that are relevant now, because we have the idea of drone warfare, that a lot more and more of our battles are being fought by machines, computers. Star Trek The Next Generation hit that with an episode called The Hunted, where a race of beings on a planet genetically engineered a race of soldiers to fight wars for them, and then just kind of discarded them when the war was over, didn't really treat them as citizens. There was an episode called Ensigns of Command, where there was a human colony that would refuse to leave a planet that they weren't supposed to colonize, and if they didn't move, this species called the Celiac or Sheliac would wipe them out. Commander Data had to convince them to move, and so that kind of hit on the idea of like who owns what land, who has to move and who doesn't. It's based on treaties and law. Of course, the colony believes they have every right to be there, but they have to be moved. You know, sound familiar? The relocation of Palestinians and whatever. There's also in the movie Star Trek Insurrection where the Baku are on a planet and there's an alien race, I forget their name. They wanted to control the planet for its resources and they wanted to relocate the Baku. So it was kind of a question of who has the rights to live on that planet. And the truth was neither of them really had much of a claim. The only one, but in the end, the Baku had the greater claim because they actually lived there. They didn't just want to extract resources from the rings around the planet, et cetera, et cetera. So the ideas of self-determination, of who owns what, you know, property claims, the law of the sea, the law of the land. And and Star Trek just gets philosophical on historical figures. And they don't, most of the time it's Western thinkers. And I think that's just a product of that's just the writers going with what they know. But there's one episode where they actually went with a Chinese philosopher was quoted. Sun Tzu was quoted in an episode called The Last Outpost. Basically, an AI was challenging the Federation to prove their worthiness, and if they didn't, he would blow up the Enterprise. Because he wanted the Federation to prove, the Enterprise to prove they weren't an invader, they weren't an attacker, and they weren't a belligerent. And this AI guardian took hold of the Enterprise and challenged Riker. And Riker basically refused to, Riker basically said, yeah, we are a people with flaws. And the AI challenged him to defend himself and Riker refused to. Basically said, no, our record stands on its own and we prefer to win without fighting. And this AI, and that was the line from Sun Tzu, to win a war without fighting is the highest form of victory. And kind of the sentiment is that if you can, you should try to gain what you want without fighting, without soldiers, without anything. And the AI guardian found that appealing. And so he decided not to kill the Federation and he let go of the Enterprise. He saw that they didn't want to get things through force. And the Ferengi, who were the other party there at the time, were prepared to just destroy the Federation and say, you should just destroy them, you know, period, just kill them. And the AI kind of saw through what they were doing. So those are all the things kind of done with diplomacy, with strategy and whatever. And those things come up in about, I don't know, 20% of the episodes. I love that stuff. I nerd out on that stuff all the time. I love reading about that stuff. So that's why I just went through all that. I love that shit. So all right, now let's get past that to some other nerdy shit that maybe somebody else might find interesting, but I just wanted to cover that because those are some of my favorite parts of Star Trek, some of my favorite episodes. All right. Another part that comes up in a lot of Star Trek episodes is kind of the ethics, like a lot of ethics lessons and legal lessons. I mean, talk about really nerdy stuff, but these are the kind of things that some people fixate on a lot, and one of the big things that Picard cites a lot and is later cited in Voyager is the Prime Directive, the idea of non-interference and non-intervention in lesser cultures and lesser civilizations that are not ready. And this kind of concept comes from, Gene Roddenberry, but I think the I think it's Gene Roddenberry's idea, but also it's just a lesson of history when the conquistadors arrived, you know, and met the Aztecs, or when we when we moved into the United States, the Native American cultures were largely wiped out. There was upheaval, there was chaos. I mean, things just did not go well for the less advanced civilization. And historically, that's been true all the time. But at the same time, historically, the superior civilization has come there to conquer them and extract resources and do whatever. So the superior civilization, in at least in human history, has not gone there out there with very lofty or humanist objectives. On the opposite side is kind of what you see in Childhood's End, when these overseers or overlords come and actually help us. And there's a 10 to 20 year transition period where they're trying to help us do become a better species and solve our problems. And that's what a lot of people feel like alien first contact will be like. That's why people dream of, you know, UFOs and species coming and helping us to become a better people, because we can't do it on our own. The Prime Directive is a rejection of that, and imposes this kind of line that if a civilization has not reached a certain level of technological and societal progress, that it's better to just not intervene. And even if that means watching a war unfold and watching them tear each other apart. And a part of that kind of applies a little bit to how a lot of people feel today about us going into third world countries and trying to stop civil wars or impose peace. You know, that we're the world's policemen and that we know better. We can redraw maps and impose new governments on countries that don't want it, et cetera, et cetera. So the Prime Directive says, no, you are not going to intervene unless they have reached a certain level of sophistication. And even then, and usually that intervention means you will not even let them know you exist. You'll fly over their planet, you'll hide, and you'll observe. You won't even make contact until a certain point, and then all you'll do is make contact. After that, the exchange will be gradual, and it would be carefully done, and et cetera. So and I think that's kind of the lesson that it's kind of the lesson of colonialism with, you know, Columbus and the conquistadors. And I think it's a lesson that we Americans are learning in the last 15 years, that it's extremely difficult to go into a country that, one, where the people don't really want you there, and two, you don't really know how to fix their problems. And some of them, they need to fix on their own. And that's kind of the lessons that a lot of people think we've learned in Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that. That was touched on in Star Trek in the episode Who Watches the Watchers, where a Star Trek observation post over a primitive society malfunctioned, and Star Trek personnel accidentally came into contact with the primitive race, and in the end had no choice but to reveal themselves in violation in order to save lives. You know, multiculturalism comes up a lot, a little bit, and especially in Next Generation, where you have weird and what we would call primitive and barbaric practices, like, for example, with a lot of the stuff the Klingons do, and we have to sit back and just respect it and not intervene. And of course, in a way, like, they're not really, they don't intervene, but they do, I mean, they love to give people lectures on what. Or maybe not lecture them, but always kind of comment and maybe make little snobbish comments about these weird Klingons or these weird people over here, or these weird, and all their weird customs. Like, well, we respect their customs, but they're weird. And there's so many times where they're kind of dismissive and kind of like, nowadays, you know, those are all kind of like considered microaggressions or something. But Star Trek always said that, like, look, you have to let them do what they do. Doesn't mean you have to be polite about it, but in the show, like, very often they would come across a culture, like, for example, a culture that says you have to commit suicide by a certain age. There were cultures that, you know, some people were raised to be perfect mates, to be perfect wives or perfect husbands. That's how they were trained. That's their role in their society. That's all they do. They don't have any kind of you know, there's caste systems in a lot of these societies where you do what you're programmed or genetically assigned to do. And Star Trek and the Federation kind of sit back and judge them and kind of evaluate them and have a philosophical discussion in their kind of meeting room. But in the end, they won't intervene. So it's kind of like that snobby person who will make some comments, but in the end, they're not going to do anything. And that's kind of the prime directive in Star Trek in a nutshell. Like And I mean, there's been the one where Wesley Crusher was sentenced to death for falling into a garden. That's respecting another country's laws or another planet's laws. There was Worf wanted to die after becoming paralyzed. You know, the ethics of euthanasia. There was the quality of life ExoComms episode where a tool designed by the scientists demonstrated behaviors of self-awareness. You know, how do you know when to treat something as a living being or as a sentient being and when is it just a machine? Or kind of the question of, you know, if we went out there, would we be able to recognize sentient life or life in general? Or would we just look for something that looks like us or acts like us? Trying to think of some of these other episodes. Drumhead kind of looked at the paranoia and conspiracy of McCarthyism. They were looking for a potential saboteur on the Enterprise, and it turns out there was no sabotage, but they still found somebody who lied on their application about being a Vulcan or a Romulan, and that kind of set things in motion. So Star Trek The Next Generation, which is the one I'm most familiar with, that's why I'm citing it the most, touches on all these things, all these kind of legal... most of these are legal questions, but also ethical questions. And I'm still not done yet. There's still a lot of stuff to talk about. I just talked about international diplomacy and international relations, just hit on legal and ethical, and we still haven't talked about, you know, societal values of tolerance, of genetics, of, how to deal with difficult people, you know, personality-wise, never mind their culture, but their personality. I remember one that was brought up on Jesse Mercury's show was the episode called The Host, where a Trill, which is a symbiotic species that joins with a humanoid. And sometimes that joining can be, and they can switch genders, male, female, they can switch species as long as they're humanoid. And the episode was about Dr. Beverly Crusher falling in love with one of these Trill, and the Trill switched from their male body to Riker's body, and she made out with him because it wasn't really Riker, it was the Trill, and Riker's personality and Riker's self kind of faded to the background. And then the Trill switched to a female body, and Beverly Crusher kind of rejected it and said, no, this whole thing's over, and kind of demonstrated a little bit of anti-gay message there, at least in Crusher's mind. You know, she can handle the love of her life, you know, switching male bodies, but as soon as he switched to female, couldn't handle it. There's also the episode The Outcast, where there's an androgynous race that wants to that doesn't have sex, doesn't have intercourse, doesn't have two genders, and one of them wants to experience sex with Riker. So you can imagine where that went. Let's see. There's the Barclay episodes, which are awesome. Lieutenant Barclay, who is he's maybe Asperger's, maybe just, I mean, social anxiety disorder, very kind of fearful and, you know, kind of a hypochondriac. So he has a lot of kind of antisocial, or I don't know what the right word is, but basically he doesn't, even in a ship full of nerds, he is a weirdo. And you just, in the episodes he's in, he contributes. You just have to get past his awkwardness and some of the things that are, maybe a little abrasive and tough to deal with. But in the end, Barclay is a very important contributor, and it's kind of like one of those messages of, you know, somebody might be weird and different and seem like they're weak and seem like they're not coping and just more trouble than they're worth, and in the end, they actually end up contributing something very important and being very important. The episode's also got personal, too. Like, I've kind of been starting, like, really up high, like international relations, national law, societal values, and now kind of like there's also the personal stuff, like the overcoming of hatred and fear as the big things. I mean, those are the biggest things about the Federation. Everything they're built on is to go out there and explore and engage in these people without fear and without, you know, knowing that this is dangerous and that you might be putting yourself in danger and you might have to do things including exercising restraint, even if it means somebody has to die. You know, missionaries are familiar with this when they, I think there was a movie about that. I forget the name of the movie, but they went to go see this culture in the I think it was the Amazon rainforest, and they were trying to make contact, and the tribe, which had never seen, you know, modern people before, reacted violently and threw spears. And these people, you know, they could have reacted. They could have, I think one of them had a gun. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But they did not try to fight back. They just died. They were murdered, basically. But they did not want to harm these people that they went out of their way to find these people, to make contact. So if you were to, like, go into the Amazon rainforest trying to find somebody, there's a problem, and you end up killing a few of them, it's like, why did you go to the rainforest then if you were prepared to kill somebody to defend yourself? You know, don't do that. So they went in there knowing they'd be putting themselves at risk, and they did not, you know, they restrained themselves and basically allowed themselves to die rather than fight back or kill. And I think that comes up in Star Trek numerous times, that they are putting themselves in, by going out there and trying to meet new cultures, they're putting themselves in danger, because there is a part of them that says, look, we can't just go out there and start fights. The only way to make contact is to demonstrate our non-aggressiveness, and that means putting the ship in a lot of danger. And, you know, if you listen to national security people on TV or whatever, these people that are obsessed with security, the idea of putting yourself in any danger for any reason is just beyond them. I mean, that's why we have a Secret Service that protects the president from, you know, bee stings. You know, we just, God forbid, we put him or anyone else in danger. If we can't help it, we're just going to build a wall around everything. And Star Trek takes the opposite approach. Like, the only way we're going to learn and explore is if we put ourselves in danger. And you have to overcome your fear. Also, to understand other people, you have to overcome your fear of the unknown and fear of what you don't understand. That happens tons of times in the original series and Next Generation, DS9. Integrating new peoples into your society. Assimilation has kind of a bad vibe to it because of the Borg. But, for example, I mean, Spock is an alien on the USS Enterprise. They wanted to show the integration of alien species in this Federation. They only managed to do one. But on the Next Generation, you have Worf, the first Klingon in the Federation. You have Data. In DS9, you have a Ferengi wanting to join the Federation. And you see a kind of a breaking down of the barriers between the Cardassians and the humans, the Ferengi and the humans, and you see almost the beginnings of a closer relationship despite the violence and the wars that have been fought between them. And that was kind of like, that's kind of the liberal fantasy that we can, you know, we can overcome. We might fight wars, but in the end, if we're always looking to have peace, eventually we'll find it. And eventually we'll integrate and become one big happy family. So kind of the experiences of Worf on the Enterprise being a Klingon when most of the people around him don't really understand Klingon culture. Quark and the experiences of his kid, I think it's his son, the Ferengis on DS9, you know, Spock as a Vulcan among humans. I mean, these are all stories of aliens integrating with humans and humans learning to live alongside and work alongside aliens. Another cool episode was Attached, when Picard and Crusher became psychic and could read each other's thoughts. That was very, very cool. They didn't end up hooking up, which I thought was going to happen. But because you figure a man and a woman who already are very close, you know, become psychic, either two things happen. Either once read each other's thoughts, you know, there's a huge fight, or they end up in bed together because they start sensing each other's feelings. Well, nothing really happened. Also, I mean, the other joke is, you know, from the movie What Women Want, where a man can, you know, a man starts learning and listening to what women think, and Mel Gibson turns from a total douchebag piece of shit into an actual compassionate and understanding man who gets in touch with his feminine side, which is the way some people say it. And I remember Dave Chappelle had a sketch about the other way. It's like, it wouldn't work the other way, where if women could read what men thought. And it shows this woman getting into an elevator and all these men just in their heads commenting on her body, on her, you know, on her tits and whatever. And it's like, it has to be what women want. If it was what men want, women would just get disgusted if they could read our minds. And I sadly have to agree with that. The only way that would work is if the psychic link went both ways, because then they both have to read each other's minds, and you have kind of a sharing of something. So the one-way psychic thing, yeah, that's just good for comedy. Of course, revenge, the desire to kill, Star Trek Into Darkness, you know, Kirk wants revenge, and Admiral Marcus tells him to go get revenge, and Spock talks him out of it. Says, no, let's apprehend him and bring him to justice. We have a justice system. Don't suspend the rules just to satisfy your anger and satisfy your desire for vengeance. That comes up in Wrath of Khan, of obviously the movie, the progenitor to Into Darkness, and a few other times where Kirk and these other Kirk and Picard could have retaliated. You know, they could have sought vengeance. They had the power. They have a powerful ship, and in so many episodes, they don't. They just kind of, you know, we're okay. Nobody died. You know, the ship was damaged, but we repaired it. So we're okay now. So we're not going to retaliate. It's not an eye for an eye, and we're not going to do a second strike. So there's another little cool thing it's more personal, because the captain, a man or somebody on the ship, can decide, can they, you know, be put through pain and still not get angry and want revenge, as Kirk did against Khan and et cetera. I think Star Trek also had kind of lessons on leadership, more about, wasn't just Kirk, Picard, and Sisko, and Janeway. It was also sometimes the second in commands, and just kind of some ideas on leadership, on management. If I remember, like from a lot of the shows, they'd go into their briefing room or the conference room, and Picard would kind of leave it open and kind of listen to everyone's opinions and ideas. They'd all be respectful of each other's opinions. They would try to workshop the answer. All their egos were usually kept at the door. They had to like stay calm, be like, look, you're like Worf, for example, who gets 90% of his ideas shot down. He always just kind of took it. He was always a little, you know, he's a little frustrated, but it kind of melted away because he respected them. But Picard would defer to his crew. He would never just step on people and say, no, this is how we're doing it. I'm tired of this, and you guys are frustrating me. I asked for this. You did not deliver it. He never kind of, he only criticized them when they really, really deserved it. Kirk was also the same way. He asked for a discussion, you know, and really with the original series, Kirk was in the middle, and he was kind of like the, you know, in psychiatry, I guess he would be the ego. And then there's the super ego and the id, you know, it's like the three sides. Or maybe a better sci-fi analogy would be like Sith and Jedi. You know, Vulcan, Spock is a Vulcan, he's a Jedi, he's no passion, he's all logic, he's all reason. You know, there's no passion there, whereas, you know, McCoy is all passion, which is the Sith. Star Wars, it's good and evil, but in Star Trek, it was treated more as two different sides of the same personality, that we all have like a Bones and a Spock in our head. You know, whichever one you give the most influence at any given time, or maybe you favor one over the other, and then there's the person in the middle, Kirk, who tries to balance it. But he always kind of lets them talk and lets them go back and forth, and there's kind of like this respect for each other. It's not dominated by Kirk. He doesn't dominate the discussion. He doesn't tell them to shut up. He doesn't tell them that, no, you're wrong, and I'm doing this. And when people's advice is not followed, they don't take it personally. Picard was the same way with, you know, I said Worf, you know, Worf gets shot down all the time. And I think there's internet memes on YouTube or YouTube videos of Worf just getting shot down for about 15 minutes straight, you know, taken from all the episodes of the show. You also see kind of the selflessness of these. I mean, these are all really good people. I mean, these are all very talented, high character, high integrity people. And you see them time and again sacrifice themselves for others, for the ship. And it's expected of them, but we expect that from people in military and positions now, but you know, we don't always follow through. And of course, in a lot of the civilian world, which, you know, Star Trek, the Federation and Starfleet, it is part military, but it's mostly civilian. And in the civilian world, you're not expected to sacrifice anything, like your life. You're not expected to sacrifice your life. But in Star Trek, since they're explorers, they are expected to. You have to. You have to be willing to die for the Prime Directive, which was the case in Into Darkness, or to save the ship, to save the 1,000 people on the Enterprise, or however many were on the original. There's a lot of instruction and education on Star Trek, but it's lead by example and a lead by action. LaForge, you know, is the top engineer, and whenever there's a big job, he would do it. He would not send a second person on away teams. All the top officers went. They did not send a bunch of ensigns, which is what, you know, every institute, you know, every major institute in our government does now. We send in people that are expendable. We never, God forbid, we send in the general or the president for anything. The captain of the ship maybe will put himself in danger in the Navy, but generally, like, you know, the danger is shared by all. But in Star Trek, the officers are expected to lead by example and to put themselves in the same danger and sometimes in some cases more danger. And really, they all embody kind of part of what we should all aspire to be, not just as, you know, servicemen in Starfleet, but because LaForge is an engineer, he's not a soldier, but he does wear a uniform, he does take orders, but he's an engineer. You know, Data is basically a scientist. Worf is a security officer. Picard is the captain. But I mean, everyone has almost like a civilian role to themselves, and so what you see in Star Trek is not a military unit, and they don't always behave that way. What you see is what we could be if we decided to join and be part of something greater, and also as a society, like what we could be. I mean, we see that, and there's like a little bit for everyone. There is, you know, the daredevil, the risk taker, like Riker and Kirk. There is the philosopher, like Spock or Picard. There's the statesman, which is largely Picard. There's poets, historians. There's the, you know, the steadfast, you know, courageous security officer and Tasha Yar and Worf. And then there's just geniuses like LaForge or Wesley Crusher or Scotty with his engines and these other people. So there's you see them all working with each other, being part of a ship's crew, but also friends So in addition to being about leadership, it's also just about how we can be with each other without having like a captain or a lord or a king or a CEO running the show. They all just treat each other equally, and they don't pull. The only person that really ever pulls rank is the captain. Everyone else kind of treats each other as equals, even though they're technically not in the same rank. Most of them are a varying lieutenant commander, lieutenant whatever. So it's about what we could be as people individually towards one another, as part of a group, as part of a society. It is kind of a preoccupation of how we can better ourselves. You know, it's how we can be better as a state, as with the ethics, the laws, how we choose, because the law is really largely about how we treat each other and how we're going to live with each other in the same space. How we are not going to hurt each other, how we're going to establish commerce and trade with each other, and who is how we are going to make decisions. That's law, that's ethics, and Star Trek gives a glimpse of how we might do that in the future. And then, of course, how are we going to deal with foreigners, aliens, alien empires, foreign empires, disputes within us? You know, it's about all the different things we could be in the future. Yes, it has for people that are more kind of obsessed politically, yes, it has a liberal lean to it. It has kind of a leftist lean to it. But they don't really get into that part of it much. They skip over that kind of those controversies to talk about the new ones. And I speak from somebody who is, I'm not really a liberal. I have some liberal views, but I don't call myself that. But even when I watch Star Trek, I'm not offended by anything on that show. Once in a while, yeah, there's like some snobby comment they make about, oh yeah, back in the old days when we did that, yeah, that was barbaric. And they're usually talking about conservatives, or they're talking about something that, you know, we still accept as what we are now. We don't consider it barbaric, we consider it, I won't get into that, but anyway. So that never bothered me. It does bother some people that are obsessed with politics and obsessed with ideology. They think Gene Roddenberry, I've actually read this, that he was like a left-wing hack, which I think is ridiculous. I mean, if he's a left-wing hack, then everything that Hollywood and television has ever made is a hack. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, I didn't even read the article. I didn't even want to. I don't know how somebody can create something like Star Trek and develop the following and the obsession it has, and you can call the guy a hack. It's just dead on arrival. Or call him an ideologue. You watch that, and I mean, if that's what an, yes, he is an idealist. He's talking about where we're going 300 years from now. To me, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with being a utopian or an idealist. I mean, as long as you're not beating someone else over the head or using it as a platform from which to attack and criticize the ideas you disagree with. And Star Trek doesn't do that. Star Trek is showing you where we're going to be after we're done with all these arguments that we're having now. He's not settling the arguments. He's not telling you the right answers to these arguments. He's saying, look, after a while, these arguments won't matter. It's not going to matter who's right in the future. No one's going to care. It's going to be part of history. And we'll all move on, and we'll all move on to other problems. All right, so I'll sum up a little bit. I'm going to close it off here. I've been going on for a while. Talk a little bit about the reboots. I did do a review of Star Trek Beyond. I was disappointed, not in the movie itself being a failure, although I did have some criticism. It's just disappointing to me that all three movies are basically the same, and that the reboots have decided to tell the same story in three slightly different ways. They're all three are basically about revenge and boys with issues, and father issues, daddy issues. And also, it's all about military combat. It's about war. All three had to be about war. And sadly, I think, as much as I love, the casting of the new reboot is awesome. The chemistry, the way they're with each other, the fun, the smart parts of it, the idealistic parts of it, some of it is there. A lot of what Star Trek is in the reboot. But there's also facets of it that they haven't touched yet. And like I said when I started this, Star Trek is huge. Star Trek covers a lot of ground. It is a very, very large franchise. And these three movies have basically hit one side of only one facet of it, or two facets of it at the most. There's so much more ground to cover, and in three movies, they have not covered it at all. They've basically kept to the safe side. The phasers, torpedoes, motorcycles, and you know, driving cars off cliffs, all the badass stuff, you know, and they've completely dropped the science. They've completely dropped the philosophical side of it. They make fun of Spock, and they cut Spock off when he starts into any kind of serious conversation. That is not how Spock was treated in the original show. Or he was a little bit in the movies, but really not that much, mostly because he had just come back from the dead. So in 3 and 4, he is kind of scoffed at a little bit by Bones. I think Carl Urban as Bones is awesome. He does Bones, I think. Well, I mean, I think he hits that character maybe better than DeForest Kelly. I mean, he is hysterical. And Zoe Saldana was a great choice for Uhura. So the visuals in the movie, the special effects, the quality, the production is amazing. They just have not covered nearly enough ground and stretched out and challenged themselves to hit on a lot of the things that Star Trek hits on in the movies and in the old TV shows. There is a new show called Star Trek Discovery coming out. The showrunner is Brian Fuller, who has a pretty good Star Trek pedigree. He wrote for, I believe, Voyager and DS9. The other producer, I believe, is Alex Kurtzman, who has a pretty good science fiction pedigree. I think he was a writer for Fringe. And some of the things they're saying, I think Star Trek Discovery takes place 10 years or 5 years before the original series. So it's before Kirk, or maybe contemporary to Kirk, but before the show. So some of the things that happened before the original series, another kind of prequel style. Not sure how I feel about that. I was always hoping that one day they would go past DS9 and Voyager and be like the next generation, but I guess that's pretty hard to do because a lot of new technology and a lot of facets and a lot of weird things happened. And it's kind of hard to one-up that, and it's kind of hard to bring it back down to a level. You know, and especially with these reboot movies, I think TV is going to have a hard time going back to that more intellectual model and more of that multifaceted model, which is a combination of plot-driven and character-driven shows. It's turning into more of like a Fast and Furious in space kind of thing. And I think I have high hopes for Star Trek Discovery. I think it's very cool. I think the people behind it, I don't know anything. There's nothing about the casting. We just know where it takes place in the timeline and what it's going to be in very, very broad strokes. The movies, I don't expect the next one to be any different. I don't think they can slow down and go to a more heady, problem-solving diplomatic movie after basically three war movies. I don't think they can. They're just going to have to make a fourth. I don't think anyone's going to be happy with, anything otherwise. So maybe a time travel movie. Maybe a version of Journey Home will be the next one. Maybe people will be satisfied with that. I don't know. But that's for the movie. Discovery comes out January 2017 on CBS All Access. And as far as I know, those are the two things that the franchise is going forward with. I have not heard of any other TV shows. I don't read the books. I know there's like 100 Star Trek books out there. Some people love that stuff. I just have never gotten into Star Trek books. Not to say they're not awesome. For people that are in, I'm sure they're awesome. I'm sure there's a lot of things I'm missing. I just don't read them. All right. I think I've gone off enough on this. I'm about out of beer. Patrick Stewart's the man. And it blows me away to this day that Patrick Stewart, the man who is Captain Jean-Luc Picard and Professor Xavier, also does the voice of Director Bullet in American Dad. And he also does voices. He does the voice of little Susie, who is Joe's daughter, baby daughter in Family Guy. I mean, and just to find out that him and Ian McKellen are just buddies, you know, Gandalf and Professor X are buddies. It's just, I mean, go to his Twitter account, you know, just go anything Patrick Stewart, man. The guy is, I mean, he's just the man. And he did Shakespeare. He did one-man shows for a while. He's done Shakespeare in London and England and even in New York as me. I mean, the guy is just, I want his life. Aside from the baldness, I don't know if I could deal with baldness, but every other facet of his life, like he has lived the coolest life, and he apparently isn't aging. Just go check that out too, by the way. Patrick Stewart hasn't aged in the last 30 years, so there's something to that. I don't know what, but there's something to it. That'll do it for this episode 36 of Thought Crime. I am going to try and do an interview with my good friend Retzi Bruno for the next episode. We're going to try to do that this week. If we can't fit it in this week, I might just do an episode either solo or maybe with someone else on the Star Wars cartoon series, Clone Wars and Rebels. I've written a couple blog posts because I've caught up on both of those shows. Yeah, they're cartoons and yeah, they're for kids, but you know, if you're a Star Wars fan, you even as a grown man, you find things in there to enjoy. But in any event, those are the two topics that are kind of in the hopper. So that's what you might hear for the next episode. But that'll do it for this episode of Thought Crime. Until next time.